Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 28th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. We are jam-packed today, ladies and gentlemen, even though it's a casual Friday. Joining us in studio, Brandon Sutton of The Discourse, also known as Pretty Bad Lefty on Twitter. Then we will get a brief phone call from Dave Weigel, the Washington Post / CIA, who will be giving us an update on what's going on in South Carolina. As you know, there's a primary there tomorrow. And then joining us in studio from the Reply Guys, or, I mean, other things, her career, Kate Willett will be with us. Meanwhile, the Mad King insists coronavirus is a deep state ploy. And our total lack of preparedness is all in your head. And speaking of which, a Health and Human Services whistleblower says that it was HHS workers who may be the cause of some of the coronavirus outbreak in this country. Whoops. And on the eve of the South Carolina primary, the day's eve of the South Carolina primary, Joe Biden up by near double digits, apparently. Meanwhile, Super Tuesday, just a couple of days away, polls show Bernie up in Massachusetts, of all places, and with a 2-1 lead in California. Meanwhile, Warren supporting Super PAC makes a $9 million Super Tuesday buy. And one of the DNC superdelegates promoting a brokered convention turns out to be a big Republican donor because of his lobbying business. The SEIU has committed now $150 million to mobilizing low-propensity voters in the general election. Turkey is getting pulverized in Syria. It's now opened its border and is sending refugees, Syrian refugees, to Europe. Meanwhile, Erdogan is slamming India for Muslim massacres there. Idaho bans trans people from correcting their gender on their birth certificates, which I imagine was a huge problem in Idaho. Must have been very difficult for people there to deal with that. And the new IRS taxpayer advocate is a 20-year veteran of a corporate accounting firm. Using some of that great experience in helping taxpayers to help taxpayers. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. I should say that the last taxpayer advocate was basically a person who worked with legal aid, had a background there, and started the first low-income taxpayer clinic of its kind in the U.S. And this is sort of to balance that out, where KMPG is almost like a clinic, but for super high-income people and corporations, and therefore that person is better suited to help taxpaying clients.
It's important to respect everyone's lived experience.
Exactly. So it's a little bit of balance. Right, Brandon?
I mean, you have to be able to see both sides of the issue. You know, I think that's the important part here. You know, sometimes the tax code needs to help poor people. Sometimes it needs to help rich people. In this case, I mean, when it starts helping poor people, that'll be great. So
there you go. I mean, so you're basically saying what this is an investment in potential future justice.
I mean, there's a concept in like psychology called moral balancing. It's like that, but at the social level. You have to, you know, you have to balance out the immorality of helping the poor by with the morality of helping rich people. So
I didn't know there was a name for that concept, but I think I was mentioning the other day that when I quit law school, I was determined to also quit smoking to sort of balance those things out. And it took about 20 years, yeah. But I did it eventually.
I'm not going to quit smoking, but
right.
One day.
I understand. Well, maybe you should quit law school and then they'll force you to. Okay. Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, check out the AM Quickie. It is a great, what's that? Brendan said it's doing gangbusters and he sort of did it half under his breath, so I couldn't understand what he was saying. But it is doing gangbusters, apparently. So check that out. We have it out the door by 8 a.m. unless there is some type of major technical screw up. And it is a great way to sort of keep track of the news in a very brief amount of time. So I know you'll enjoy it. Check it out. amquickie.com. Just a little bit of house cleaning. We are going to be doing some Super Tuesday live here. And we'll be covering it. We may even have a whiteboard. We've been talking about having a whiteboard here. So that makes it pretty official when you have the whiteboard. So, Brent, the race is what it is. We're going to talk to Dave Weigel in a bit in terms of like what's happening in South Carolina. There was a poll that came out today that shows Bernie up in Massachusetts on Super Tuesday. Incidentally, if you're in the Worcester area over the weekend, John Benjamin and I, two Worcester natives, are headed up there to, I guess we're going to do some type of show for canvassers. So if you're thinking about canvassing this weekend and you want to head to Worcester, Massachusetts, which is the heart of the Commonwealth and has an incredibly, the metro area there is enormous.
I went to a cool weed dispensary there last time I was
there. I didn't even realize that. I have not been to that, and I will probably check it out just from a sociological perspective.
I went to college in Worcester.
You did?
Not that one, though. The one in Ohio. So
they're
pronounced the same, spelled entirely differently.
That's correct.
Different state, too.
It's not so crazy. There are 11 colleges in Worcester. I'm not going to get into my Worcester boosterism, but that's an opportunity for folks.
Booster. Sorry.
Let's talk about this is the big story right now is this whole sort of dynamic about, the question that was asked at the debate and then this New York Times story that has contacted 93 of the 770 superdelegates and the majority of those 93, I guess, or a significant number. Said that they are, at least some of them, are willing to, in their words, destroy the party to stop Bernie Sanders. Damage the party, destroy the party. Now, apparently the story in The Intercept, if you're a lobbyist and you have some Republican clients and you're also maxing out to Republicans, like, it may not be that hard to understand why he might do that. It's a harder question to understand why that person is a superdelegate. Or maybe the answer is more disturbing. But broadly speaking, what is your sense and your take of all this?
I guess going in order, I think that it would absolutely destroy the Democratic Party. Because I think that let's say Bernie Sanders gets the plurality of votes. He comes in at 48% of the delegates after the primary. And he goes into the convention, all the energy, all people there are excited to vote for him. And they just say, well, you know what? We're going to coalesce around a Pete Buttigieg hopefully not Biden, or Pete Buttigieg, you know, a Bloomberg, even a Warren, you now have 48% of people who voted feeling as though like their vote was just thrown out. And I think that there is this tendency among people who are getting themselves amped up right now to go like, oh, well, it's within the rules. The rules say they can do this. This is totally within the rule books, but no one cares about the rules. Right. It's like that. Like that's, you know, the only time you start referencing, in my opinion, the only time you start referencing rules like that is when you're getting ready to cheat. It's when you're getting ready to do something incredibly immoral, rather not cheat. You're getting ready to do something that's going to upset people, and you want to have an excuse for why people should not feel aggrieved by it. At the same time, though, I don't think they have the courage to do that. I don't think they're going to have the courage to destroy the party, at least not the Democrats, maybe the Republican donors who are
right.
Definitely they would. But like the people who are actually higher up Dems, who even if they are not, let's say, progressive or liberal, they're your center, they're center right Dems. I mean, they are not going to have the courage to come out and explicitly state, hey, we want to disenfranchise. We want to disenfranchise the 48% of voters and just have them stay home. I think it's much more likely that Bernie will be the nominee and they will just try to sabotage him on the back end.
That is exactly the way I feel, too. And I would say, like, look, yes, it is the rules. Bernie in 2016, the fact is that he was playing the same game. Everybody's going to try, and particularly at this stage in the, you know, before, you know, let's face it. The reason why people think Bernie's going to win is because of what he's doing in the polls and because he has the most robust combined with organic, because, you know, Bloomberg probably has a more robust in terms of dollars machine built for the rest of the race. Nobody else even comes close. I mean, it's Bloomberg and Sanders, and Bloomberg's are all paid. There's not, I mean, I'm sure there's some people who genuinely, deep in their heart, have always dreamt of a Bloomberg presidency.
I would never want to meet those people or spend any time alone with them.
I think they're probably not interested in meeting you
either. Like, just like legit psychos. Not even racist, just like legit. Like,
exactly. But there's, you know, we haven't actually, I don't know what percentage of delegates have been awarded at this point. You know, probably, I don't know, like 3% or something, you know, somewhere around the death rate of coronavirus, at least if we believe the numbers coming out of China, which I don't. But that's it. That we'll talk about that in a bit. But it is the rules. The party, if everybody decides they can do it, it's certainly within their rights to do it. I'm not even convinced that it's necessarily immoral to deny a plurality of the people. But the fact is, and I don't care who is would come in with the plurality. I think it would have been the same situation if it had happened with Clinton. I mean, when they were talking about the superdelegates being the difference, you know, for two candidates that lacked a majority in 2016, I thought that was wrong, too. The superdelegates should be a rubber stamp unless there's a situation where it's like on June 15th, somebody gets indicted for, you know, murdering their spouse. And there's like sort of wide, you know, like broad acceptance that like we can't have that person be our nominee. And at least we have a legal, because the fact of the matter is that the rules are there so that there is actually a non-actionable process in which you could address a situation like that. I think from a practical standpoint, it doesn't matter who's in the lead. And I think, you know, maybe if the lead is razor thin, I mean, you said 48%. That to me is a slam dunk. But the real question is going to be like, so I'm looking at this, Nate Silver did a multiple scenarios. What if of what happens from here on in? And one is scenario one. And Matt, I sent you the link here, so you can put this up on the thing. Scenario one is after a big Biden win in South Carolina. Now, I don't know what constitutes a big win. People are anticipating maybe a low double digit win for him there. It used to be like a, what was like 30%?
Yeah, he came in real high in South Carolina, and they've been slowly chipping away at that. But I mean, you know, I don't think it's out of possibility he comes in, wins South Carolina by 10, 12%. That just seems like, I mean, it was a big gap, and he, you know, Bernie closed a lot of it, but.
Yep. It's true. And so here's the first one right there. This is the first scenario one. And even there, right, you have Bernie with 39. This is the best case scenario for a second place, close second place finisher, 39 to 29%. Now that's where it starts to get murky in my mind. 10%, like, I'm sorry, if someone's at essentially 40%, I think to appoint essentially a point for the, even though it's the delegates who appoint it, somebody who's coming in with a 10% less, is, you're just inviting a loss in the general election. And surely that candidate would know it. And surely all of these like Democratic superdelegates would know it. And I think you're right. It would be much more efficient for them to just say, like, Bernie wins. And then, like, we'll see you in December.
Let it be a self-fulfilling prophecy. They'll pretend as though the negative coverage, the negative backbiting, the subtle jabs and sabotaging had no effect on why he's losing, right? Because they do the same thing for Medicare for All. You know, you'll have many different think pieces decrying how bad it'll be, decrying how we have to save Obamacare. Then when Medicare for All starts slipping in public popularity, they go like, see, like we told you, yep, it's not popular. And it's like, well, yeah, but you're missing the intervening issue here. The fact that, like, you've made it less popular. So, but what I think is going to occur, and at least when you see numbers like this, is that it's not feasible. It would be a mask off moment for Democratic Party to say, like, you know what, Sanders, we see that people like him. Not only do people like him, but even using the logic of the other candidates for why they should be appointed, he is the unity candidate. Let's be honest. You know, like, he is a lot of the major candidates out there. He has the most overlap with people, being people's second choice. So it seems like even with these numbers, he might lose South Carolina, Florida, that appointing him or like allowing him to be the nominee would not be deleterious to the morale of the voters themselves, just the higher ups. And so I think that speaking from that level, it's like, it's not even about the people who will stay home because they're Bernie or bust people. It's about, like, actually framing this as, well, Bernie is the unity candidate. The people who are not getting behind him are a very small minority of people who just happen to have actual material stakes in him becoming president. Right. But everyone else, you know, I think a lot of Democratic voters we've seen polls that show, like, a lot of Democratic voters for Biden or Warren or Buttigieg, they're just party functionaries. Like, they're going to vote for whoever the nominee is. You know, if their preferred person doesn't win, the turnout might be a little bit lower, but not to the degree that a Bernie Sanders presence, a lack of Bernie Sanders would be. And so I think that really it's coming down to the fact that can Bernie Sanders make the accurate assessment and accurate claim that, hey, you know what, he is the unity candidate. Everyone would be like, there's going to be the least amount of people who are dissatisfied with him being the nominee than any other case here.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if there is if there is an audience even for that outside of the circles of people who really wouldn't want him anyways. Like, I'm the whole unity candidate thing, I think, not just in the context of Sanders, it's just like, I don't think the average Democratic voter perceives this huge riff that we're all aware of because we're watching, you know, Neera Tanden and Dave Sirota go at it. And it feels like it's a huge, like, I just think that that's why I thought Warren's I'm the unity candidate didn't resonate with anybody, because people were just like, wait, what do you mean? No, is there a fight?
I don't think the average voter perceives that as being a problem, but there is certainly a fraction of the base, and the base that likes Bernie Sanders the least, which is like professional class, suburban liberal voters who watch MSNBC all the time and kind of have MSNBC brain, who vote regularly and are an important constituency.
Yeah, I don't know if they see, I don't know, I'm not convinced that they see there to be, you know, that I think they're just like, I want to get rid of Trump.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's, you know, that point you're making right now is exactly why it would be so deleterious for the Democratic Party to come out so aggressively against Sanders, right? Because I think your average Democrat who's just like half paying attention to what's going on, doesn't really know the rules about, you know, superdelegates, doesn't know the way the actual delegate count is breaking down right now. They just see like, oh, Bernie won the first three states. I don't know. Like, I think that particular person is fine with Bernie Sanders. Yeah. They're fine with him. Like, you know, they just want to get Trump out of office. They want to get, you know, they want to get, they want to put a, they want to close the book on this like negative chapter of their life. They want to go back to brunch, and Bernie's a way to do that too. And so like the more Democratic Party sabotages that, the bigger the schism between like their voting base and their higher and their establishment is going to become. And so like that's something they have to safeguard against too. So, I mean, they're being pulled in two directions. Like, you can go against Bernie, but you're going to lose a lot of the voters who are just not going to understand why you don't like him so much.
Yep.
Because, you know, not to borrow some of your phrasing, but the Democratic Party, in many ways, they sowed a suit for Bernie Sanders. It's like, if you're just a Democratic, if you're just like an average Democratic voter, and you like, you're not really entrenched and steeped in like what they're actually up to, and, you know, in capitalism, neoliberalism, you think they're the party of women and people of color and like workers and providing health care and Obama. And then you see someone like Bernie Sanders come in, he's like, yeah, I want to provide health care. You know, I marched with Martin Luther King Jr. It's like I was doing X, Y, and Z in the 70s. You're like, oh yeah, that's cool. Like, that's exactly what the party, that's exactly what I stand for. And so the party coming out antagonistically against that is a bad look for them, because it's like, well, why are you so against this? And the argument that it's because it was just not practical doesn't appeal to anybody.
Right. I think a big part of what they're trying to do, and they have not been able to really successfully do it, is to find the thing that they think will resonate with those people. And I think, I mean, to the extent that anything has, it is, I think, still a taste in people's mouths from the 2016 election. And that's why he does the cohort where he does the least well is with suburban women, which, I mean, that's a hugely important cohort. We saw them, you know, come out in 2018 in the big numbers. But I think a lot of that is an anti-Trump sentiment. And in one respect, that's why what's happening with coronavirus, just to sort of tacked over, we're going to obviously come back and talk about at least South Carolina when we talk to Weigel for a moment. But that's why I think the coronavirus is one of those things that in the general, right? Like, I don't think it's going to help necessarily any Democrat in the primaries. I mean, I think some people are suggesting it might help Warren but I don't know that that idea that she is the wonkiest of all the candidates is necessarily really that heavy on people's minds. I think it still ends up being like, we got to beat Donald Trump.
A lot of people in the media have a very weird relationship with Warren. Like, it feels like there's been, more so than Pete and Biden, there's been, at least among the, you know, the pundit class of like center leftist, you know, thinkfluencers rather, that they have like supplanted their ego with Warren's candidacy, and they identify very strongly with her. And so, like, you know, I'll go back to the debate before last. I did not watch the last debate. I couldn't do it to myself. And, you know, going into that debate,
that was very smart.
Going into that debate, I was like, no matter how Warren's going to do, that people are going to be saying Warren did great. And she did do great in that the debate before last. But it's becoming clear that there is a desperation amongst a certain minority of her supporters. And they may be overrepresented in the media and pretending like she's still viable to the degree that she's not. And so, like, and so I think that's coloring a lot of commentary about her in a way that's not necessarily like...
My sense is that what we're seeing is, and it's indicative of the failure of her campaign, I think. And I'm talking from a political standpoint, because I happen to be a fan of her as a candidate, as a senator, and, you know, as a would-be candidate. But it's been clear that, you know, I think the first time I was introduced to the idea of like policy is personnel or personnel is policy was somehow through, you know, reading about her, you know, over the past 10, 15 years, that when it comes to doing public facing politics, there's a huge deficit there. And she's picked the wrong people. And frankly, there's been too many gaffes that I think make me feel comfortable that she could beat Donald Trump. I mean, I know everybody says, like, you're not supposed to think about who can beat, but I'm sorry. That's what everybody's thinking about. And also, I think from a legislative perspective, like, there just seems to be a misunderstanding of what her value proposition is on some level. And I think what's happening now is that there are other people who are now sort of been brought into the campaign who are saying, you've got to get back to that point of just being you, and have people discover that you are the best that the establishment of the party is going to get in this cycle, because if it's not Warren, it's going to be Sanders. And they want an extra 10 percentage points that I don't think is out there, that they feel if they had, she could be a viable compromise candidate.
I mean, that's my read of it too, right? I think that Warren did her best when she was, you know, trying to stake out her own lane, even if it was a little bit close to Bernie, right? She was doing her best in the beginning when she was, you know, when she was staking out her own lane, when she was emphasizing the things that she is an expert in, you know, banking, you know, finance. There are, you know, there are some issues with her, you know, with her analysis, or rather her prescriptions there, but like those things that can be worked with. She's still far and ahead the best the Democrats have to offer. But I think that that shows, like you said, a lack of, I don't know, reflection upon the party's elite. Because from my perspective, at least in the beginning, right, Warren is the best argument that liberalism, that Democratic parties, like, you know, whatever Democratic Party establishment's ideology is capable of solving the problems that people have in their lives. She was the best. Like, she yep. is the, she was the face of that. And like actually articulating the policies that she had, they weren't all good, but she was thinking them through, you know, like she had people working on them. She was putting them out there for feedback. But over the time, you know, it transitioned to, like, I'm going to say it honestly, a lot of Clinton staffers, a lot of you know, Clinton staffers moved from campaign to campaign, like a plague of locusts, like just destroying them. And like, they were determined to turn her campaign into another repeat of like, of Clinton's campaign 2016, just like they were with Kamala Harris's campaign. And I don't know what that's supposed to prove other than that Clinton cannot win the presidency.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, I think some of the people were also sort of some former Obama people too. I mean, there was a real mix in there, but what happened is they all started with like knowing, and I think this was the case, that if there was a path to the presidency or to the nomination for Elizabeth Warren, it was good because she was going to be the compromise candidate. And instead of just letting her be Elizabeth Warren and do exactly what you say, rest on her strengths, which were in that finance, consumer protection era, you know, area, they made her the compromised candidate, where it was like they were trying to land in the right place. And it's like it was over-engineered.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that, you know, again, the idea of a unity candidate is flawed inherently. But had she stayed in the place she was in the beginning, had she stayed there and still come in maybe second, third, maybe third place, let's say minimum, she came in third place, I think she would have had a much better argument going into convention, that at least among Sanders supporters, I would have voted for her. At least in the beginning, I was like, yeah, you know, a lot of other people were, you know, against her, for some for very legitimate reasons, some for illegitimate reasons. But I was like, you know what, if it's Elizabeth Warren, I'd be okay with that. I think a lot of people since then who were fine with her have absolutely gone like, what's happened? They don't even understand what's happened to her campaign. And, you know, obviously you can't say it's Clinton staffers, like, it's entirely their fault because she hired them, right? She's in charge of that. So that's a judgment call. But even that, I would say, speaks to, I think in her campaign, in the rise and fall of her campaign, is a lesson about trying to speak to both the center and the left base at the same time, and even more specifically, trying to appeal to the core of Democrat, you know, the Democrat media political establishment classes, like values, and just like not realizing that those people are just not broadly representative of everybody else. And then you find yourself in a situation where it's like, okay, yeah, instead of being, you know, a compromise candidate, the best of both worlds, someone that people are genuinely happy to vote for, you find yourself being, you know, having still a bunch of op-eds written about you about how like you're a great candidate, but that's not being reflected in the polls. Right. It's like, it's a, you know, she got into that bubble and she allowed it to affect her judgment in a way that I don't know if, you know, if she can recover from at this point. I think now she's with the super PAC thing. My read of that, because we won't know who is putting money into that super PAC until after Super Tuesday. My read into that is that it's bad. Is that the people who are putting money in that super PAC are bad, and she knows that they're bad. But like, you know, a Clinton staffer, an Obama staffer is getting rich off of it. And so like, you got to hold your nose and let it. And they're hoping that that money, like that ad buy, will get her enough attention and, you know, and support, and so that when it comes out who's supporting that PAC after, it'll be
irrelevant.
It'll be irrelevant.
Yeah, because largely, like, it's only relevant to people like, yeah. I mean, there's not a lot of, I'd be shocked if not, you know, out of 100 voters, 99 go in there, and unless they're specifically interested in getting money out of politics, and even then, will be like a super PAC. What? Like, I don't know what that means. Even, I mean, or at the very least, it's not going to influence their thing. But, and I didn't want to spend this much time on Warren, but I do think it's the most fascinating story of the campaign. I would even argue that the takeaway is even broader than that. It is a situation where it's like she was the product, if you will, was fine on day one. It's just the problem is that you start bringing in a bunch of consultants and executives. They're like, well, I've got to put my imprimatur on this product. And otherwise, like, you know, I need to, you can find this, I think, probably in every industry. And I, you know, I always relate it back to executives, you know, looking at the script writing where it's just like, I read, you know, so therefore I can comment on this script and I have to. And it's like, do you really think that the dad should be should have a mustache? You know, like it's just sort of like, well, let's put a mustache on him. And they're trying to really use the candidate to create their own value. And that ends up bad things come from that.
I agree. Go ahead.
Don't you think the presence of these people and their continued prominence in campaigns like Elizabeth Warren shows that this kind of kamikaze mindset is still alive and well in the Democratic establishment? Like, I don't even think that they would frame it in the terms of we're willing to hurt our own party to block Bernie, because they really believe that he can't win. They really believe that he is a risk on the level of someone getting indicted or whatever. And we already know that they're great at assigning blame. You know, if they believe Bernie can't win anyway, there's no harm in cramming one of their candidates down everybody's throats. And then when they lose, once again, they can blame Russia. They can blame racism. They can blame Bernie Sanders. They can blame any number of things.
I mean, I'm talking about the people working on the people working on Warren's campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. But these are like the same people that I'm talking about.
I don't think they're the same people. I think they have a different sort of different agenda.
Well, I'll address, I guess, both points. So the first, and like I'll combine them in the way I conceptualize it. The first is like I think that you're right, and because of that, because of her campaign, the loss of her campaign, she started out so high or high-ish, and you saw such a sharp downtick, like. Her campaign, more than any of the others, more than Kamala's, more than any of the other failures, it implicates that class of people. It heavily implicates the political media consultant establishment that hangs on to the Democratic Party, like Remoraids, or like, and like sort of feeds off that. And so I think that's part of the desperation amongst the people who are self-dealing and, you know, and have friends across all industries.
Yes.
to make sure that they still pretend that she's viable, because more so than any other, she's proof of concept that these people do not know what they're doing. You know, the fact that they,
right, because she is a very substantive candidate, and she actually, you know, like Kamala Harris had a problem in that there was no product, underlying product, exactly. There, you essentially
know. And so I mean, as an example of that, like, look, you know, she was endorsed, half endorsement by New York Times meant nothing. Right. Absolutely nothing.
Even with Times readers.
And what does that imply? What does that imply about the social capital, the ability to influence and control the narrative of these people, the ability to just do their job? Like, what is their worth if they can't, if they can take a candidate like Elizabeth Warren, who has substance, who is very popular broadly, and just absolutely tank her career,
yep.
What exactly does that mean? And to Jamie's point, I think there's a difference between like the people at the Democratic Party who know that this is a grift, who know that they're just here to make money, you know, who know, you know, they might believe generally in the ideas, like the broad framework of liberalism. They're definitely not Republicans, but like they're just like, this is a career for
them. They're in an industry.
They're in an industry. Like, this is like, you know, plenty of people work in industries they don't believe in. Just because it's what they're good at. And so, and then there's the people who, like, for, you know, surround them as another ring, who are not grifters. They're half paying attention. They, you know, they believe in the values of the party. They are supporting, like, they're trying to support the party. They want equality. They believe in social justice. They may not understand all the, like, you know, the phenomenon there, but they believe in those things. And like, there is a schism between those two groups that's becoming more and more visible as the race goes on, and the middle group becomes out in their own class interest against Bernie Sanders, because the class interest of that core does not broadly represent the class interest of that ring that surrounds them.
It's not even, I don't even know that it's necessarily a class interest in terms of like an economic class, yeah, because there are those people who probably feel like I'm in the Bernie's industry. Yeah. Like this is a classic Coke and Pepsi type of thing, yeah, where it's like a lot of people, I think, and it's, I think there's more of these people than not because of the nature of Bernie's campaign, but also not just from an ideological standpoint, but that he's been in independent circles, that he's been sort of like outside of the party apparatus, et cetera, et cetera. There are a lot of people who are just like, I'm not going to get a job.
Yeah.
Like I'm not going to get a job in this administration. I'm not going to get the sinecures that I was getting from the DNC because he will take over that apparatus, or his people will, and they will hand out contracts to other people. Yeah. And they may actually even have rules where it's like, based upon the way that Bernie's campaign has gone, like, we're not giving you 15%. And it, you know, I saw it in the entertainment industry at one point, like managers got 15%, and then people just decided they're getting 10.
Yeah.
I mean, so you may not, as a media buyer, get that 20% VIG that you were getting. And then all of a sudden, all the consultants go, well, actually, Texas is out of reach. I mean, the reason why Texas is always in play is because it's a huge media center. And so the only way you can run in Texas, man, in a statewide race is to buy TV ads. I'm going to buy them for you. I get 20% VIG.
You know, I agree. I mean, there are definitely a lot of people, not a lot. There are definitely a few people, you know, billionaires, obviously is one class, but like just the Democrat consultancy, people like Neera Tanden, let's be honest, who a Bernie Sanders president is an actual real threat to them. It's like, it's a real threat to them. They're
not an ideological threat, like a material threat, and not from their taxes, because I think a lot of these people have no problem with taxes. Yeah. Certainly Warren's, Warren's campaign, Warren's programmatic thing has as much, you know, tax burden as Bernie's, but maybe close, at least, you know, from their perspective. But I think what Warren tried to do is to assure that sort of Borg, if you will, like, I'm not as much of a threat to, like, literally your ability to pay your mortgage.
Well, a lot of people are very comfortable with assigning the blame of what's going wrong in society to billionaires, like to just billionaires specifically. And that's the end of their, you know, big banks, billionaires. That's right. The end of their analysis. And they don't understand the entire culture or surrounds that, and like the tentacles that come out of that. And so Warren represented a Bernie type candidate who people could broadly get behind ideologically, but the people in certain industries like consultancies and the media who would be implicated, if not by, well, essentially by Bernie's analysis, had exemptions carved out for them by Elizabeth Warren's analysis. At least they felt that way about it, along with the technocratic aspects of it. My only addition to what you call it, to your point though as well, would be that Warren's candidacy it was sunk by listening to those people. Like, it was absolutely, like, she is proof of concept for why you should not have, you know, dealt with those people, and why that particular, like, why that particular industry is just absolutely a Ponzi scheme. Yep. It's essentially just, it's a lot of self-dealing. You know, it's kids of maybe once really, really good political operatives. You know, like, we don't, you know, Harry Reid's like niece, or Harry, right, Reid's, like, it's like, yeah, like, if, like, Harry Reid, you know, like
yeah, it's a full employment program for the fail sons of, yeah, actual political people.
I mean, on my show, one of my co-hosts called this like intellectual Habsburg syndrome. It's like, yeah, it's like you might have started off with like people who really, really smart, really capable of leading, but all the self-dealing, all the incestuous nature of like the political media consulting class, you end up with just like someone's dumb stepson is now the head of this think, yes, tank. And it's like, and it's being,
and we
revealed.
Should be clear. This, I think, is an affliction that is not unique to politics.
No.
I mean, it is in, you know, I feel like it's been in every industry that I've ever been associated with, including the restaurant I worked at.
And so, I remember my point.
I want to
now.
Hear more about that.
Well, it was a lot of BS. I got fired.
I would remember the point I was going to make was that, like, also, you know, what you hear all the time, at least when you're online, is, you know, how unprofessional David Sirota is, how unprofessional, like, the members of Bernie Sanders' comms and, you know, Breonna Greyjoy and all the people are, and how, like, they're terrible and terrible and terrible. And it's just like, it's clear, though, that they have run one of the most effective campaigns in the past, decade of politics since I would argue Obama ran in 2008 and Obama for America. It rivals that, maybe exceeds that. But, none of the ire at that campaign, the ire aimed at them is entirely because they're outsiders. It's not about their competency at their job. They do a great job. None of that ire is aimed at the people who sunk Kamala Harris's campaign, Elizabeth Warren's campaign.
Right.
I'm not a fan of Kamala Harris, and I might get flack for this, but I think she deserved better than what they gave her. It's like what the Hillary Clinton campaign staffers did to her. Like, she was her own candidate. I didn't like her. Kind of sucked. Was an agent of the police state. But, just trying to rerun Hillary Clinton's campaign with her at the forefront of it was disrespectful.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
Don't you think that people's ideology often follows their class interests? And regardless of whether they're driven by ideology or interests or patronage or some combination thereof, like, the outcomes effectively are the same.
Say again?
Oh, like, you were talking about whether people are driven by ideology or just needing a job in this, like, circle jerk of patronage. Don't you think at the end of the day, the outcomes are the same and it maybe doesn't matter so much?
So, I mean, in my opinion, I agree with you. The outcomes in this case are what matters. I think we spend a lot of time, especially in political media, worrying about whether someone's a bad faith actor or whether they're just stupid. That at a certain point is irrelevant. It's just at a certain point, you should know thy enemy, but the outcome of the fact that they are continually engaging in malfeasance or continually smearing people is the most important thing. Trying to argue whether what the intention there is a way to absolve them of any kind of moral or intellectual responsibility for what they're doing. When it comes to the ideological aspect of it, I think what we're seeing here is a centrist class, and this happened in 2016, crystallizing. And by crystallizing, I mean there have always been centrists throughout history, but when I say centrist, I mean that their ideology is mostly a reflection of their position as comfortable under the current status quo. And so their ideological components are just myopic, solipsistic, reaching out this enriches me. And if it enriches me, it's what's best for society. And I think that's what makes the centrist class, which has other attributes, a little bit difficult to deal with, because their version of what represents a positive social order is entirely founded upon what's best for them. And so they look at someone like Bernie Sanders. I think this is where it melds together. They look at someone like Bernie Sanders. They say, well, he's bad for me, and therefore he must be bad for society.
Right. But I think the reason why it does make a difference that the outcomes may be the same is that theoretically anyways, and I don't think you'd want to do this, but I'm quite convinced that if Bernie announced one of the other things that we're going to do is we're going to establish a fund to fund a huge think tank, and we're going to hire all of you. Oh. I think literally the next day they go you know what? Actually, I'm starting to see that this could work.
Maybe, just transition program.
Right. I don't think that their ideology, I don't think they share Bernie's ideology, but I think it's enhanced by the fact, I think a lot of these people can get over the ideology if they thought but I'm going to get hired, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think once it becomes sort of uncontroversial, if it does, that he is the nominee, there's going to be a certain percentage of those people who are going to come over and say, I'm willing to get on board if they get the call saying hey, we need you to do these comms things.
Well, the good news for them is that Bernie wants a federal jobs guarantee, but that may not satisfy them because they might actually have to do some work.
Right.
I think what you're speaking to is that, at the core of this party is a mix of grifters and true believers. But I think that the number of true believers who have a true, real ideology divorced from hey, you know what, whatever gets me a job is what's good, is very small by this point. I think there are very few people within the Democratic Party higher ups who are operating on I just really like center right neoconservative.
I agree. I think you have that, and then your priorities become a lot more me focused at that point. All right. I wanted to talk about coronavirus. We can talk about it maybe after Weigel when we bring Kate in, who my understanding is a physician. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so she can discuss this. But I think where I was headed before we got sidetracked is that in the general election, coronavirus has the opportunity. One of the concerns about Bernie is that he changes the election, not for everybody, but for certain cohorts, from a referendum on Donald Trump to a decision between two different candidates. That is what the concern is, particularly with suburban women, is that it goes from purely I'm coming out to vote against Donald Trump to, and I don't know that it is, but this is the concern, and I think there's some validity to it, at least at this point, you know, and we're far out from like the actual choice when I think things become a little bit more rational. But that it's going to change it from a referendum election for certain groups to a decision between two candidates, in which case then it becomes harder for the non-incumbent. I mean, that's just the way that elections work. Coronavirus, I think, is something that has the potential to inoculate, sorry to stay in the medical world, but to inoculate the election from becoming a choice between two different candidates for that cohort and become remain steadfastly a referendum on Trump. Because if I'm in the suburbs and I am worried about my children, I mean, everybody is, but I mean, we're talking about people who are, you know, helicopter parents, and I'm worried about my kids going to school because I'm seeing that the complete failure of our government to just do the basics. I'm just going to go in there, you know, I'm going to be reminded that, like, oh, not only is he offensive and, you know, maybe an autocrat, but he's not even one who can get the trains running on time.
I mean, I don't know if you know this about me, Sam, but I'm a social scientist. And so I would consider myself to be an expert in suburban moms because I watch hundreds of hours of Lifetime movies.
Yes.
And that's the target audience. So I have a lot of, you know, text analysis of it. And so I think that you're right. I think that the coronavirus is, if properly mobilized by the left and by Bernie, is a proof of concept of everything he's talking about. It can be used as a proof of concept of literally everything that he has been talking about this entire campaign. On the flip side, you know, the suburban moms, like Trump, even Trump could weaponize it. This could be a referendum on immigration. It could be a referendum on like just the fact that we have a population of people, you know, whether it, you know, it becomes like maybe, you know, Mexicans coming in have coronavirus next. You know, so I think that we have to be careful about this could go either way. I think coronavirus could be weaponized either way because a pandemic is a very, you know, very energy rich.
That's definitely what they're trying to do. But, you know, like when Trump says we should close the border, I think Chuck Schumer should go like, oh, you want to close the borders? OK, no more flying in and out of the United States.
Yeah.
And see how quickly.
No more commerce.
So yeah, exactly. Let's not take any more ships. If Mr. President, if you want to propose that. Because we will respect national unity, although we're against it, we will say okay, and then see how many hours that lasts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's that. All right, we're going to take a break here. We're going to give a call to Dave Weigel just to get a sense of what's going on in South Carolina. I believe he is on the ground in South Carolina. Maybe at like probably south of the border. So I think where he would probably hang out. Do you know that place? Your family's from South Carolina?
Yeah.
Oh, so you've probably spent most of your childhood at south of the border buying fireworks.
Myrtle Beach, buying fireworks and funnel cake.
All right, we'll take a quick break.
So listen to me, sister, listen.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program from the Washington Post, the political reporter from the Washington Post, the author of the trailer, which is an email blast that you can guess, and of course, a double secret agent with the CIA, Dave Weigel. Dave, welcome back to the program.
No, it's good to be here, man. The whole company thanks you.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad I'm on the right side of those things. Now, are those truck engines I'm hearing? Are you at south of the border? Brandon's here. His family's from South Carolina. He did not even know what it was. It is the world's greatest truck stop, right at the border of North Carolina and South Carolina. And you get all sorts of fireworks.
I'm not there. That sounds awesome.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's funny because my grandfather was actually a trucker. So.
Oh, there you go. Where are you?
I am at a Caribbean place that is in Sumter, South Carolina. I'm about to get back on the road to go cover the final Bernie Sanders rally before the primary. I just finished with Joe Biden. So the beeping you're hearing is, I don't know. ignore any sounds around me. I'm safe and I'm certainly not doing any work for the CIA.
Okay. Well, as long as that's the case, I mean, that to me, that beeping sounds very South Carolinian and it's providing a nice audio context. That's what everybody says when you go down to South Carolina.
It's saying bless your heart in Morse code.
Bless your heart. Whenever I go to South Carolina, people always say to me, make sure you check out the beeping. So, all right. So what's your sense? I mean, the polls, there's a lot of polls that have come out. I've seen ones. I think Data for Progress had one where Biden was up by 9. Yeah. And then I've seen ones where he's up by, I think, like 20. Give me your sense of, A, where Biden's support is relative to the other candidates, and B, where it's been and what the trajectory has been.
Well, he's always had very strong support, but less strong than Hillary Clinton did 4 years ago. That's kind of the story of the Biden campaign everywhere. That he has been really no lower than the high 20s in South Carolina, and he hit those numbers in some states, but not many, in Iowa, New Hampshire, states that he would end up giving up on. So he is fairly strong here, and I think some people let expectations get out of hand, the idea that Bernie could win the state outright, that if it happened was possible only because Tom Steyer was splitting up some of the non-Biden vote and some of the non-Sanders vote. Without that, with Biden having a pretty good debate performance, with him getting the endorsement of James Clyburn, he could win, but it might be a much less commanding win than Barack Obama. And it's going to be almost certainly a much less commanding win than Hillary Clinton. I mean, Hillary Clinton won by more than 50 points here. That gave her the delegate margins that reshaped the primary. And really, Bernie Sanders was never able to catch her afterwards. I don't think he'll see the same thing here. But I do think in the last few days, or the last week, there was a could Biden lose South Carolina speculation that was probably a little bit too fanciful for Bernie people.
So really, it's just going to be a question of, it seems to me, or I guess I want to phrase this in a question. Do you think it's going to be a question of just how well the Biden surrogates do? And by that, I mean, maybe just even some of the actual hosts on some of the networks, but the people going on to create, because they've been setting up this narrative of like, if Biden does well enough, there could be enough momentum where he'll show up in, Super Tuesday, and it's going to change the dynamic. What is your sense? I mean, wouldn't he have to have like win by like 30 points for that to actually happen? Or do you think, or what? I mean, is that your sense of what the game plan is if you're Biden's people?
Well, even James Clyburn, who endorsed him, was saying he wants to see a win of closer to 15, 16 points. Even that would be the narrower win than Barack Obama got in 2008. It'd be comparable to John Edwards beating John Kerry here, and John Edwards did not win the nomination. So I think what you're identified something pretty important. There's some spin going on, especially among commentators who either think Sanders would be a disaster or are looking for a Biden comeback. He could win here, but he could win by the kind of margin that really blows up the delegate count. I mean, let's say he won by 20 points and Tom Steyer didn't get any delegates. He'd probably get, actually, despite the split up vote, a lead comparable to what Hillary Clinton got last time. Maybe 5 or 6 delegates less. If it's a, or it could be a narrower race, he could get a net of, I don't know, 6 to 9 delegates. And I don't want to get too weedy about this, but if you're looking at his challenges coming forward, he might have problems building on a win of that scale, because even if you look at his ad buys and his travel, he's effectively conceded a lot of Super Tuesday states already. He's conceded Colorado. I'm not speaking for the campaign, but he's not going to them. Colorado, Minnesota, Utah, Maine. There are places that vote California, and but talking about winning in Texas, has a ton of endorsements there, might not be winning there. So the idea that he could get a huge bounce off this and change the map is, I think, a bit much. And then if you look at the idea.
Oh, you there?
He's going to be. I'm still here.
Yeah, sorry, you just cut out. Yeah, go ahead. It's not going to change the map.
So, well, if you're talking about momentum, there are places that have been early voting for weeks. I mean, Texas basically is wrapping up early voting this weekend. Like California has been early voting to the tunes of hundreds of thousands of votes. And we actually saw in 2016, there were a ton of votes for Jeb Bush in Texas, even though he dropped out before the primary. So a lot of votes are being locked in while Biden looked really weak. Now, were there people who were deciding between Sanders and Biden? You can kind of roll your eyes, but yeah, some people were. They shared some of the same demographics of white working class voters, and also voters who just want to vote for the candidate that they are told can win. And Sanders actually didn't get a lot of Sanders can win coverage. Frankly, one thing that was on my mind as I was with Biden in Fort Sumter, in Sumter, South Carolina, I should say, is that his poll numbers against Trump, his personal favorability, has been slipping since he started entering the race. But you don't really hear that discussed. You do hear anything negative about Sanders. So I think Sanders's momentum has been suppressed a bit by some of the coverage, by some of his ability to get a ton of new voters to turn out. And I think Biden's being helped by this idea that he's a huge underdog now.
But at the end of the day, I mean, I'm just trying to think of a scenario where it's like Biden gets a 12-point win in South Carolina, and then all of a sudden the money just pours in for him. Like, it's almost like the idea of like, oh my God, he's got this huge surge of money that's come in. Like, who's going to do that? Like, I can't even think, like, you know, I just can't, like, there's no scenario. I mean, I can see that they may have a day or two where, like, he's the comeback, you know, kid in quotes. I mean, you know, the comeback maybe guy. But the idea that like $20 million of money are going to roll into his campaign based upon that just seems to me to super far fetched. And he just my sense is, and you tell me if this is what you know, because you've been on the ground to a lot of these places, is that really it's just Sanders and Bloomberg are the only ones who have sort of the resources in terms of not just in terms of dollars, but in terms of like people on the ground who have been there long enough to have developed like an infrastructure in these places.
That's true. Warren has an infrastructure in a number of the Super Tuesday states. She's stronger than you might think in Texas. She's fairly strong in Minnesota. She was. There are places where I think she's lost ground as voters have started to get nervous that she might not go the distance. But a lot of people had bigger organizations than Joe Biden. Biden has been depending on actually more of a slingshot than Hillary Clinton did. Hillary Clinton had pretty organizations in Super Tuesday states. Biden has not been running ads there. Now, people know who he is, but he's not as present. And he hasn't built organizations beyond, you know, big teams of endorsers. That is not harmful per se, but Virginia is a good example. I mean, there have been Sanders people canvassing for weeks. There haven't been people canvassing for Biden. He's got the endorsements of Tim Kaine today and a couple other people in Virginia politics.
Whoa!
But it took a while, and that is. I mean, how many people does Tim Kaine get to knock on doors for him? That's a big question.
Right. All right. Well, Dave, is there anything that you feel like we haven't touched on? I mean, obviously we're going to talk on Super Tuesday, so we'll leave the powder dry there. But is there anything that you think is uncovered that we should be talking about today that's going to be relevant over the next couple of days?
Well, I think you know it pretty good. Well, you need to have clear eyes about what these primary votes mean. I mean, if all the states before Super Tuesday were combined, they'd be the fourth biggest state on Super Tuesday. So most of the delegate selection is coming up. And even after Super Tuesday, 62% of the delegates are left. Hmm. So you set that up pretty well. I mean, I would say that the Bloomberg factor is interesting here because the way that a Biden win could affect things is if a voter who has seen Bloomberg's advertising and worries that Biden has been fading, if there's an idea that all they need to hear is, oh, Biden won something, and they will stop flirting with Bloomberg and go back to him. But there's a question of how much Bloomberg already did in those states and whether those votes split the right way. So continue looking out for the 15% threshold. Polling sometimes we have a poll that warrants at 14%, and people will say she's getting no delegates. That's a little simplistic. If she's at 14, she's getting delegates in a lot of districts in the state. But that is the worry that anti-Sanders people had, you know, for a year, and that they kind of stupidly fell into by just not deciding on one candidate to face him.
Right.
Is there look at whether candidates are in a position to get any delegates at all, and if they're not, so here's how it works. Let's say there's 100 voters and Sanders gets 50 and two people get 25 each. That means they'll split the delegates 2-1-1 if there are four in the district. Let's say Sanders gets 50 delegates, one candidate gets 30 delegates, and then a bunch of other candidates split the rest but don't get 15. But that means they only are calculating the delegates based on those first 80 voters. And that's going to happen in a lot of places. That's what happened in Nevada, where only about 60% of voters picked either Sanders or Buttigieg or Biden in the first round. And that meant that 40% of voters voted somebody who didn't get any delegates. That could repeat in a lot of places.
Oh, wow. Okay. And all right. Mm-hmm. So lastly, let me just ask you, you know, that story that came out in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday, 93 super delegates they talked to, and they talked about like, we're willing to kamikaze this. What's your sense of that piece? Just, you know, broadly speaking.
Yeah. Well, that's a classic Democratic strategy here of not coming up with a plan, but panicking anyway. There's many ways that Sanders could lose the nomination. I think there's a sense by the Sanders people of creating momentum so that after Super Tuesday, they'll look like nobody could catch him. There actually would be time to catch him. The worry is that, and so the argument that they could use is the one Sanders used at the end of 2016, which is, look, let's say Sanders wins some primaries, but then he loses the last bunch of them.
Right.
And he comes into the convention with 35% of the delegates. I think there would be a conversation, not so much about the superdelegates, but let's say that other candidates combined for 60% and they form an alliance. That's a situation where people lose sometimes. And but the superdelegates, I'm glad that Reid Epstein and Lisa Laird talked to them, because I don't think they understand how this stuff looks. And to them, it's just self-evident that Sanders can't win the election. I would give a caution. There's an idea that they'd rather lose than nominate Sanders. I don't think that's true for most of these people. I think they honestly have just, they've been told their whole lives that someone like Sanders can't win. They just think they'd be nominating a guy who can't win the election despite everything we know about him. So that's what they're worried about. And in their minds, voters will say, oh, of course, we need anything we can to avert disaster. And I don't think they appreciate how people would actually look, even at, let's say, Sanders had 35% of the vote and the next two candidates combined had 30 and 25.
Right.
Even then, I think people would look skeptically on them trying to form an alliance.
I agree. All right, Dave, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Sorry that you didn't get a chance to see south of the border this time around, but maybe in 2024. All right, thanks.
All right, thanks, man.
Appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon. There it is, ladies and gentlemen, Dave Weigel. Kate, you want to come and join us? It's basically sounds like unless Joe Biden does something supernatural in South Carolina, nothing is going to change.
I mean, I would love to see him do something supernatural. If he does something supernatural, you know what? He has my vote.
There you go.
Like I'm not a purist. If he, you know, if he like walks on water or something.
I was going to say levitate maybe at the.
Any candidate that demonstrates supernatural abilities, I think, is going to deserve a second look.
The most supernatural ability Joe Biden could demonstrate is keeping his hands to himself. It's just like, or finishing a full sentence.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Now, joining us, we got to switch that button on the bottom there. I will vamp. Ladies and gentlemen, making her way to the studio and sitting down, Kate Willett.
Hello.
Kate, you are the host of Reply Guys.
Yes.
That's basically like, those are like people who like in a thread, a guy will come in. I'm trying to think. I just saw a great example of, you always see like one of those like where somebody comes in like, you're an idiot. They say to a woman, like a guy said,
yeah,
you're an idiot. And it, you don't know anything about animals. And it's like, I'm the head of zoology at
yes, totally.
The most prestigious university
yeah,
in the country.
Exactly.
Something like that.
Yeah. We called it that because it's a, you know, it's a feminist podcast where we talk about lefty politics stuff. And we've, I think me and, or my, rather, my co-host Julia and I both felt in 2016
That's
that a lot of the online discourse was dominated by very loud dudes. So we wanted to give a nod to that. But also, I think over the course of this election cycle, we're like, are we the reply guys? You know,
<That's right. laughs>
the more and more mad we get about like the DNC, like thinking about taking it or whatever, we're like, yeah, you know, we're up in those threads as well.
Yeah,
reply two becomes the replier.
Exactly.
There you go. I almost I noticed you corrected your grammar.
Yeah,
I was going to hop in and correct your grammar.
I know.
But
I
only after you did it, because I wouldn't have known.
I
thought there was a joke. There was like a form function joke there.
Yeah, and I saw that like on the horizon, and I didn't want to force you to become the reply guy in that
right.
moment.
I
so I was
that.
Like, you know.
And you are also a professor of English at Columbia University. Is
exactly.
that correct?
No, I'm just a comedian. I am a dirtbag feminist comedian.
There you go.
Right. With an interest in electing Bernie Sanders and other leftist candidates.
Boom. Yes.
I never reply to anybody online. And you know how I maintain that? Illiteracy. Check it out. Check it out, folks.
Nice.
Yes.
Well done.
Well, they say that literacy is in and of itself a communist plot. Did you guys see that tweet? That was
I did not see that one.
Shit.
Yeah.
That literacy is?
Yeah.
It was some guy who's, frankly, he said he's a Reaganite, but in like Poland, who said that, like, yeah, the first thing the communists do is teach you to read. This was in regards to Fidel Castro. So if you want to be an anti-communist, maintaining illiteracy is
that,
a good
can't read
step.
Marx if you're not literate.
That's also probably yeah. not the first thing they do. I just want to put that out there.
Second, third.
I mean, depends on how many people are literate.
I guess coincidentally, I went with my ex-wife to produce her documentary in Cuba some 20 years ago. And it was in part on photographers. Well, it was all on photographers in Cuba, but some of whom were Castro's personal photographers to capture the revolution, because illiteracy rates were so high that he knew that he had to tell the story of the revolution in photos. That was the explicit sort of like game plan. And then of course he did, expand literacy among other things. I've been down there. There were definitely like political repression. People were worried about saying things. I actually almost sunk the whole project by revealing to a guy in flip-flops and a tank top that we were doing a movie, and he apparently was like on a committee for the counter-revolution. Wow. And then we got our inside person at the cultural attaché, essentially, you know, gave us word, and I had to create a whole fake of dummy tapes. And apparently that's what happened with La Bamba. They went down there. I think it was that movie La Bamba. They got to the airport with all their film and the...
With Lou Diamond Phillips?
I think it was... Was it La Bamba or... It was some other... It was a movie... No, it wasn't La Bamba. It was one about these Cuban... I can't remember what the movie was now.
Motorcycle Diaries?
No, not Motorcycle Diaries.
The Buena Vista Social Club?
No. What was it? No, it was not Godfather 2. It was
Scarface.
Not Scarface. and they took all the footage. They had shot all the footage, and they just took it at the airport.
Oh my God.
that was, you know. Anyways, let's talk coronavirus. Can we please, Kate? As you know, you are the head of epidemiology
yes.
at Mount Sinai Hospital, and no.
The main thing that's important is nobody wash their hands ever.
There you go.
Ever.
We are in a sort of stunning era where we are watching, you know, one of the problems with the autocracy of China is that you can't respond to things like this, at least initially, right? Like their denial of the problem exacerbated the problem. And then when it got to the point where it's got, they have the ability to shut things down. But there is real, I think, legitimate concern amongst at least some of the sort of experts I'm reading that they're beginning to become skeptical of the numbers that are coming out of China, that they think it's probably worse than is being reported. And so, I mean, I guess we won't know for a while, but, you know, it's like watching the Chernobyl. You know, there's a lot of like CYA that goes on here. And now in this country, we're going through the same thing. Here's Donald Trump, the woman behind Donald Trump, as he's talking about it. She is, what is her position exactly? She's like the chief, oh gosh, what number clip is this? Oh yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, this is Dan, this is Dr. Ann Schuchat, and she is one of the key players in sort of the response to the coronavirus. And we should make it clear that, you know, she's the deputy director of the CDC. And watch her face as Donald Trump refers to how, like, this is not a big deal. It's like a common cold.
Any of their behaviors?
No, I think you have to always, look, I do it a lot anyway, as you probably heard. Wash your hands, stay clean. You don't have to necessarily grab every handrail unless you have to. You know, you do certain things that you do when you have the flu. I mean, view this the same as the flu. When somebody sneezes, I mean, I try and bail out as much as possible with the sneezing. I had a man come up to me a week ago. I hadn't seen him in a long time, and I said, how you doing? He said, fine, fine. He hugs me, kisses. I said, are you well? He says, no. He said, I have the worst fever and the worst flu. And he's hugging and kissing me. So I said, excuse me. I went there and started washing my hands. So you have to do that. You know,
watch your face.
I really think, doctor, you want to treat this like you treat the flu, right?
I mean, a bit, but,
you know, it's going to be, it's going to be.
No, yeah, yeah. She, now, you can't see. This footage is a little bit broken up, but the look on her face is like, no. But yeah. she can't get up and say that. And they have a concerted effort. Mike Pence's czarism on this is not, I'm going to coordinate all of the different efforts. It's, I'm in charge of making sure no one says anything that will reveal what's really going on. That seems like a problem, Kate, as a chief epidemiologist at various New York hospitals.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, you know, I would say that my official medical opinion is that it's not good, especially in a country where we don't necessarily have healthcare available to every person. It seems like it could go wrong, but, you know, what do I know?
Well, I mean, so much of this is about, I mean, we now have a whistleblower who's going out. Like,
yeah.
I mean, remember the chain of events here. The CDC, there were people coming from on a flight, coming off of a cruise liner that people were afraid had been infected.
Yeah.
The CDC did not want to fly them back commercially.
This was a Scientology cruise. Is that a detail that was correct?
Is that right?
I think it was.
A Scientology cruise?
I think it was a Scientology
cruise.
Oh, my God.
I can try to look that up.
But I'm not
sure. They do believe in physical ailments, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, sometimes with these cruise ships, people will have, like, conventions on, like, the cruise ship itself, but it not be, like, a Scientology cruise. Like, they'll just have, like, a convention on, like, a particular cruise ship. Like, they'll have, like, 150 people on.
Oh, yeah. Who knows? Like, otherwise, it's
I went on a rock and roll cruise like that. It was, like, 100 punks and a bunch of normies on a Carnival cruise ship.
Yeah, I mean, that's largely irrelevant. The bottom line, though, is that you have these Americans. They're being repatriated. The CDC said, we shouldn't do this. Like, we shouldn't do this. And the Trump administration overruled them because they didn't want anybody to think like it was a big deal. You know, it's like the Trump story. The guy had a fever. He came in and hugged me. And I'm like, come back, guy. And then because they don't want to alarm anybody, Health and Human Services sent federal workers to go and like deal with these people coming off and did not equip them in any way properly, brought them to an air base, I guess. And this guy in California who has it, they're only suspecting because of the federal regulations that basically narrowed who should be tested for this. Federal regulations that were just propagated by the CDC being stepped on by the Trump administration. They can't quite figure out where it is, but they think it may have something to do with these workers. And a whistleblower has now come out and said that they had no monitoring, no testing regime in place. And it is the first U.S. contracted, not coming from overseas, but contracted within the U.S., comes from that general vicinity. And people are starting to speculate that it's a function of that. And then apparently, when someone at the Health and Human Services talks about it, they're criticized for hurting morale and then ordered to another position or to be fired by the administration. That seems to be, you know, you're playing with fire.
Definitely seems that way. It seems like also that this could end up, like you were saying earlier, like I definitely think that they could possibly start alienating even people who have gone with them on, like, you know, some of the other corruption stuff, like people who absolutely don't care about anything related to Ukraine or, you know, Russia, I think could potentially be like, okay, well, you know, I don't want my kid to get this virus. It might start like leaking into like people who voted for him, actually.
I think that's true, too. And the stock market has, you know, look, I think the stock market, I mean, the stock market is completely overrated in terms of an economic measure. And it is helping a fairly narrow subset of Americans, you know, but they are highly sensitive to it. And as it drops, I think it starts to shake some of his support, even from like the wealthy folks.
I mean, the stock market as a measurement of like the faith that a particular part of the population has in the like the functioning of the country and of the world, you know, it's good for that. Unless you don't try to extrapolate. But I mean, look, I'm not an epidemiologist like Kate, although I do have a master's in body language analysis.
a body language expert. Nice.
Ladies. But here's what I will say about the coronavirus, just apart from the points already made. Like, I think as an epidemic, it has the ability to lay bare just how many gaps we have in our society at various levels and various points. And not just the ineptitude of the Trump administration, but like Katie said, it's like we live in a country where millions of people don't have health insurance. And not only do millions of people don't have health insurance or access to health care, even more people are health care precarious in a way that might lead them to, you know, roll the dice if they have the symptoms. Like, we have a culture of people who are just like afraid to go to the doctor, who have an instinctual fear of going to the doctor because, hey, you know what? What if I go to emergency room? My insurance company will only cover if I'm admitted. And so I go and what happens? If I'm not sick, I'd rather just wait until it gets too bad. Right. And so that's one aspect of it. And the second aspect, you know, we have a culture of people, no paid time off. A lot of people don't have sick days. You know, a lot of people can't take, you know, for a lot of people, they take off to go to the doctor, they get coronavirus. That's their paycheck, that's their rent money. And so like you're weighing like health versus, you know, going to the doctor. And just another point that people have been making,
right? I got news for you. Enjoy your salad at your next restaurant meal.
Yeah,
worked by someone who doesn't have time off.
I mean, exactly. The CDC did a study a few years ago. It came out that they polled restaurant workers, and I'm sure you remember this, Sam, because I might have heard it on your show. And they found out that 15% of restaurant workers come into work despite the fact that they are sick with some kind of stomach contagion.
Yep.
That leads to like vomiting or diarrhea. So they come to work and they handle food and they do That's how salmonella spreads, and it would be how the coronavirus spread. So there are so many little aspects of our society that are obviously always deleterious and like hurt people on an individual level, and they are able to be abstracted, or rather made into a discrete problem for individuals because we have a hard time conceptualizing something as social health. And so when you put an epidemic into the mix, people have a much easier time. It's like, oh yeah, all of these things that people struggle with all the time do not exist in vacuums. They're actually related to our society in a given flow way. And I would even say something that people are advising, or rather making the connection with, like, yeah, Medicare for all would have done a lot to abate this health crisis.
Yes.
But, you know, and no, and so, like, obviously coronavirus is a public health crisis, but I would say it's a, you know, it's a step further. It's like the lack of Medicare for all, the fact that we have so many people without access to health care, without access to medication, by itself was a public health crisis. And now that we have the influx of a, you know, of a pandemic or epidemic, I don't know the difference right now off the top of my head, but I used to, it's like that. Like that public health crisis is becoming visible to what it, you know, what it actually is, which is
right.
Like,
yeah, and the virus doesn't discriminate between who's poor and who's rich.
It's the great equalizer.
I mean, Bernie's always saying we're all in this together. Maybe that will help hammer the point home for some people. I saw a news story today about a guy who thought he had the coronavirus. He'd been to China. He got tested for it. And then he gets a bill for thousands of dollars. Then I saw Nancy Pelosi saying, oh, the vaccine should be affordable. People should have affordable access to it. Like, what the hell are you talking about?
Right. Yeah. Just give it to people.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a comedian, and so most of my friends who are also comedians do not have any health insurance. And, you know, if we need to go to the doctor, we just end up, like, paying cash. And, you know, most of my friends...
Do you pay in jokes?
Yeah, but, I mean, like, honestly, you know, most of the time, like, we end up trying to just cure stuff with, like, you know, spells and herbs and stuff like that. And I feel like a lot of people are living like that, and that is fine with the ruling class in this country most of the time. But, you know, it is going to be this thing where, like, at restaurants, the people who are serving your food may not have access to healthcare, and you may just, like, actually start to see people who normally don't care at all about the fact that a lot of working class people in this country don't have health care. Like, it's going to start to affect their lives in a real way, potentially.
Yeah, well,
will
so
doctors take a like a coupon for a free drink at Eastville or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, just like, can I pay you in all these drink tickets I've compiled?
this is you know, again, the stock market has a lot of resonance with a small number of people, but these are the people on the vanguard of the sort of the Trump support of people who are, I think, are, you know, these are single issue voters on some level. And it's like, what's my stocks doing? And this is, you know, I mean, Donald Trump has throughout his presidency talked about the stock market probably more consistently than anything else.
Yeah.
And this is, they're on the, they're at, this is Fox News?
CNBC.
And you can hear in the background, like, apparently someone is just yelling about what's going on there. I don't know if they actually do this on the floor of the stock market, but watch this.
You'll look for stocks with good dividends and things like that. How do you look at that?
So, but basically what's happening, I think, is that the reporter from the floor is speaking up to the studio, and they're picking up someone, like some broker, just going into a hallway, just going like, I can't fucking believe that. I'm on my shirt. And they're picking it up on that, I think, is I think that's a problem for Donald
yeah.
Trump.
I mean, that's his main argument. That's his main argument for his own reelection, is that the stock market was doing well and the economy is doing well. And if that changes, like, people are just like, oh, this guy's pretty corrupt, you know?
I mean, I think you both are making great points. And I think the danger there, too, is him trying to craft a narrative that empowers his far right campaign in a way that spins, like, yeah, you know, he might lose some stockbrokers because the market's going to crash. But him trying to find a way to turn this into, like, an argument against immigration, you know, an argument against the, I've mentioned it prior to Dave Weil coming on, but we already have camps in place. They already floated the idea of putting homeless people there. And we've already seen that, you know, in the case of extreme public distress, people are willing to hand over some civil rights or look past certain things. So I think there is a slight danger that this is used.
They're
as the
definitely
way-
going to try. Yeah. They're definitely going to try. But the problem I think they're going to have with that is when it's clearly not a function of, like, the coronavirus is not coming, you know, like, it's Italy that shut down. We do not share a border with Italy. the vast, overwhelming number of immigrants that come or visitors that come to this country from Italy do not go via Mexico. That just doesn't happen. And I think that that's something they can sell to their, like, the core. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. But from the perspective of, like, you know, again, suburban voters who are, to the extent that there are any swing voters in this, or to the extent that there are any voters who are going to come out and make it a referendum on Trump, and maybe the existence of, like, a Bernie on the ticket might be, you know, make it more of a decision. I think that's not going to work with them in the same way. Plus, the reality is, and I don't know from a political perspective if this has any salience, the reality is that, like, our immigration policy in this country, scaring immigrants to the extent that we have undocumented, is the worst case scenario you have when you're dealing with a pandemic.
Exactly.
Because these people, the last thing they're going to do, I mean, you talk about, like, lack of health insurance being a reason why you don't go in. The idea that I could endanger my entire family and I could get kicked out of the country because I'm sick, I'm not going in. Like, literally, you know, if this thing is as contagious as it sounds, we may have to see, like, underground clinics that are set up to service folks who are afraid of going into the hospital and getting, because it would not be absurd for them to think, like, I'm going to be on some type of registry and I don't want to do that.
I mean,
I can't be quarantined.
I mean, they're right. I mean, honestly, yeah. And I think that goes back to my point. It's an important point that you're making. It's like the infrastructure that would lead this pandemic to be uncontrollable is already there, or the lack of infrastructure. Like, ICE already does things like that. So, like, anyone who pretends as though somebody not going to the hospital because they believe they have corona symptoms or is undocumented is behaving irrationally is wrong. It's like, because there's a 100% chance that ICE will come, not 100%. There's a very good chance that ICE will come in and, like, to the hospital and you will be removed and deported back to Mexico. And right now they're also trying to denaturalize people at the same time. And so, like, escalating this is only going to cause more people to go underground and more people who might have symptoms to continue to, like, try to avoid being on various, like, lists or documented at hospitals. And so we already have all of the missing pieces in place in our society to make something like this go rampant. And now we have to actually sit down and not question, like, how we got so far down the line where it's very possible that a pandemic could just ravage America. And because we just don't have the infrastructure in place to deal with it.
Right. And we should be clear, like, you know, I don't want people to panic too much. The death rate for this at this point, to the extent that we understand, is close to about 3.5%. Now, again, the numbers out of China are, you know, certainly people are starting to question whether we actually know the real numbers. But it is extremely contagious. And really what is more likely that we're going to see is not just, like, people in the suburbs worried about their kids in going to school, but it's also going to be like, they just Facebook just canceled their coders meeting in Santa Cruz, and Microsoft's not sending people to the gaming convention. And it's like, it's not irrational to entertain the notion that, like, we may not have political conventions this year. I mean, it's, you know, like, it's not, you know, I don't think we're there. And I think it's a big leap to say that that's going to be the case. But it is not irrational to entertain that notion that if big parts of Italy apparently are shutting down. This is, my daughter texted me today because my daughter's whole, she's got a cottage industry of taking the clothes that I buy her and then selling them online to Depop. And I don't know what that is. And then she sometimes uses the money she gets to buy stuff. And she texted me today and she goes, I got a notice from Depop. Clothes I ordered on February 1st are not going to come. They don't know when it's coming because of coronavirus in China. I'm terrified. What am I going to do? And I'm like, well, they're not going to send you coronavirus in the mail. It's just like, but, you know, we're going to start to see more and more of this. There's already apparently one now official shortage of a drug that has been announced by the CDC as of today. I don't know what the drug is because it's all being made in China. All right. Well, before I want to take a break here and we'll go into the fun half. And when we come back, I want to talk about what the brain trust of the Republican Party, Rush Limbaugh, has instructed all of them to do, and they seem to be trying to do it, but it's hard. It's a hard thing for them to do. We'll be back in a moment with the fun half. In the meantime, just a reminder, this show relies on your support. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Check out the AM Quickie, also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Brandon, you want to talk about the discourse? Where can people see that?
You can
hear that.
Huh? Well, you can't see it anywhere because it's all audio, which is why I do less visual jokes now. You can find discourse on all of the major podcast platforms, Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud. And you can also become a patron of the discourse. If you like how well I fill out this split screen, if you like, the girth, you can become a patron at patreon.com/expandeddiscourse, where we have a special tier now. It's great. We have a special tier now. 10%, I'll analyze your body language. I'm sorry, $10, and I'll analyze your body language via the internet.
Well, that's pretty good. That's even more impressive that you can't see it and you can actually assess it.
When you get to the level that I've gone to in body language analysis, you don't require
you intuit.
It's intuitive. Right. It's like you can sense it. You can see the chakra points.
Kate, now I know that you aren't as proficient at the body language thing.
Yeah.
But you are an epidemiologist.
Exactly. So you can find me at various hospitals in New York diagnosing people with coronavirus and not washing my hands afterwards. You can find me, at a bunch of different places. I have a calendar online. I'm coming to Bloomington, Indiana soon to the Comedy Attic, and I'm coming to the Comedy Underground in Seattle in a couple weeks.
So how do you end up in Bloomington, Indiana? And then is there something, you have a relationship with Bloomington, Indiana, or is you going, you like, that's the way you like to barnstorm? I like to just go out to Indiana and then go all the way to Seattle.
Well, I'm doing comedy there. I'm not just visiting to spread coronavirus. I think the first time I ended up in Bloomington, Indiana was for a comedy festival called Limestone Comedy Festival, and then I ended up
and you made some fans there.
Yeah, I ended up coming back to that comedy club, and same thing with Seattle. I don't know, you just kind of like put things together as a comedian. I have a podcast called Reply Guys that I talked about, and it's a fun podcast. It's wherever podcasts are free, on SoundCloud and stuff, and Apple Podcasts. And I was also just on Colbert. So check me out on...
What's that?
The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. I was special on Netflix. I don't know. I didn't mean for this to go on for 5 minutes.
No,
I tell jokes.
What's the name of your special on Netflix?
It's part of a show called The Comedy Lineup. And it's not... The jokes I told them there are not political. It's just about how I, like to hang out with skater boys and stuff like that from another time. And I hope to go back to it again when Bernie Sanders is the president.
I see.
I could just focus on up with him.
I got some bad news for you.
Yeah.
That's what I said in the spring of 2004,
yeah,
waiting for the Bush campaign.
No, I understand. And I will continue to remain politically active when Bernie Sanders is the president. But, I'll at least put some energy into not dating skater boys anymore. Right now, I'm not even trying.
Right.
So look out, Beto.
Yeah.
You're officially, on.
You could be fighting.
Your giant teeth are officially on notice.
Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. This week on the Antifada, I spoke with Heather Fortune, formerly of the amazing post-punk band Wax Idols, about our canvassing trip to New Hampshire. The Bernie rally /Strokes concert, where one of our friends started a riot. How capitalism is ruining music, especially with regard to streaming services. And Heather spills the tea on why she quit the band White Lung, which probably none of you have heard of, but was once a really good band.
Matt?
Folks, Literary Hangover. Most recent episode is on Ebenezer Cook's 1731 poem on Bacon's Rebellion. We talk about Bacon's Rebellion, George Washington's great-grandfather's role in war crimes and Bacon's Rebellion, and some other things about it, so check it out.
And you can find TMBS at patreon.com, TMBS, or on YouTube, The Michael Brooks Show. Ben Dixon this week, right? I think it was.
Yeah, and Richard Wolff.
And Richard Wolff. All right, folks, quick break, fun half. See you there. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's a good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.